This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me David Wilkins. He's the author of a couple new books. The one we're going to be talking about most today is The Hank Adams Reader, an exemplary Native activist in the unleashing of indigenous sovereignty. But he also has got another book out, The Legal Universe, Observations on the Foundations of American Law, which he wrote with the late, great Vine Deloria. Wilkins teaches American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota, and today we're going to be talking about mostly this Hank Adams book and the larger subject, which we don't get to talk enough about on this program, and that's Native American rights. David Wilkins, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your background.
I belong to the Lumbee people, North Carolina. We're a Native nation of about 60,000 down in the southeastern corner of the state. We exist in sort of a quasi-recognized status vis-a-vis the federal government, recognized in the 1950s as a tribe, but in the 50s the federal government was trying to terminate tribes, and so we were denied services that other tribes receive, and so we sort of exist in a sort of a netherworld in between statuses.
And has that netherworld been clarified since the 50s?
Unfortunately, no. We've been pursuing trying to get that amendment stricken from the law. Vine Deloria was actually one of our big supporters in the 1970s and continuing into the 80s. But because of our size and the amount of money that the federal government feels that it's going to have to put out to meet our social service needs, the federal government and some Western tribes have opposed full recognition for my tribe. And so we keep getting close, but then things get pulled back, and so we haven't made it yet.
It must be frustrating.
Very frustrating. Mm-hmm.
And then tell me how you got into academia. And
I had finished my undergraduate degree at a small hometown college in North Carolina. And that was in the early 1970s, the beginnings of the indigenous renaissance around the country. I had read Vine Deloria's several of his books in college and was really fired up by Custer Died for Your Sins and then God Is Red, We Talk, You Listen. And I just began to hitchhike up and down the East Coast looking to meet other Native peoples and worked my way out west and wound up meeting a friend who knew Vine Deloria. And Vine, by this time, had started a master's program at the University of Arizona and in political science, but the concentration was on indigenous politics and law and treaties. And he recruited me out there, and I went out and studied under him for 2 years. That began our long relationship, and that ultimately led me sort of accidentally into the academy, because I wound up meeting a friend who had went through the program with me at Navajo Community College in 1984, who offered me a job on the spot because I was unemployed.
My wife was a nurse in the Navajo Reservation.
Is that right?
Back when, yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell me what Vine Deloria was like, and describe him for people who don't know who he was.
Vine Deloria was our intellectual titan, and he was our Renaissance man as well. He was just a powerful figure, both physically and intellectually and morally. And he's really credited by most people who are in the know with having been the theoretical and the philosophical, spearhead behind the Renaissance of Native people throughout not only North America but in parts of the world as well.
And then bring me to Hank Adams, who's the subject of this latest book. And I've got to confess my ignorance, and maybe it'll make the listener feel better, too, because I'm embarrassed to say I never heard of Hank Adams. I've been in the progressive movement for, more than 30 years.
And that's precisely why once I began to learn more about him and I began to track down the documents and speeches and testimonials and reports that he had written, I was just stunned about that. But I had read some of Vine's, I'd heard about Hank through Vine as a student of Vine's, and then I ran across an article that Vine wrote in 1973 titled The Most Important Indian. And Vine could have very well written that about himself, but of course he was too intellectually humble to do that. But it was an article about Hank Adams. And so at that time I didn't explore the idea, but once Vine passed away and I began to realize that not many people knew about Hank Adams. I wound up meeting Hank finally at his home, and I told him I would like to try to gather his materials together and put together an edited collection so that we can get his name out there. And he agreed rather reluctantly because he's a very, very shy individual. But as I began to pull his documents together, I pretty soon had a stack of about 3 feet of materials that he had authored and participated in, and realized that he really was a brilliant individual and had played a huge hand in not only the fishing rights struggle in Washington State, but in resolving two potentially very deadly situations, both in Washington, D.C., at the takeover of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and Wounded Knee 2 on the occupation in South Dakota.
Yeah, well, let's get into those. The first one, this was the occupation of the BIA building in D.C. in 72. What was behind that?
That was a culmination of a march that had began at three separate cities on the West Coast. Caravans wound up meeting and convening in St. Paul, Minnesota. There were 300 individuals. They all broke into separate groups, writing about different issues regarding to treaty rights, the status of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, jurisdictional issues, crime matters, and so on. All those groups met and put together their thoughts, and they handed all the documents and all the materials to Hank. Hank held up in a hotel room for 3 days and drafted what became known simply as a 20-point proposal, which was a three-page document that was the most comprehensive study to date and since then that would, if we could ever get it enacted, could address many of the major problems that continue to befuddle Native peoples. They then left St. Paul, made their way to Washington, D.C. Hank then stepped aside because he had been promised, or had been, the marchers had been told they would be having meetings with the Nixon administration and so on. Something happened while they were inside the building. The Indians wound up barricading themselves in, and it became a real standoff. Hank was then invited in by both the federal government and the American Indian Movement leaders, and Hank helped to broker the deal that led to a peaceful resolution. But then as many of the marchers were departing, some of them were ferrying out documents from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, many of which were classified. Hank realized that that wasn't a good move, and he began to encourage the people who had taken those documents to return them. Then Hank was the liaison who helped get those back to the rightful officials, which led to his ultimate arrest and so on.
Yeah, that was weird. I mean, so he was acting as this go-between, and he was getting the materials back from the BIA to the FBI, and then the FBI show up at his door and arrest him.
And they arrested him and two other individuals and accused him of all sorts of things that weren't true. They wound up having a trial, the evidence came out very quickly that he had indeed had a longstanding relationship with people inside the Bureau and the FBI, and the charges were dropped very quickly. But that just increased his knowledge, at least on the inside track in any country, about how gifted he was as a negotiator, as a strategist, and as a peacemaker. And then that carried over into the following issue, which was Wounded Knee 2.
Now, was he a member of American Indian Movement?
You know, he never self-identified as that, but he was always sort of around the major demonstrations that were taking place, although I don't think he ever became a card-carrying A member.
But he was very well known to the leadership there and sympathetic to the cause.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so tell me, set the scene for Wounded Knee 2, and then tell me what Hank Adams did there.
Wounded Knee 2 was, again, a culmination of issues on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, in which you had a corrupt tribal official, tribal chairman, Dick Wilson, who was being challenged by Russell Means, who was considered the leading face of the American Indian Movement. There was a lot of tribal corruption. There had been several deaths of Native individuals that the FBI nor the tribal police were following up on. And so a number of AIM individuals, at the request of traditional elders among the Lakota people, encouraged them to come in to try and to make a stand for justice. As they did that, they were then confronted by the tribal police and tribal officials. It led to a standoff. And then the AIM leaders and their supporters on the inside then barricaded themselves inside a small hamlet. The federal government then swooped down with massive military armament, surrounded the encampment, and for 73 days, people weren't sure whether there was going to be a major bloodbath or not. And again, Hank Adams was invited in by the federal government, also invited in by the AIM leaders and the traditional people, and he was the one that single-handedly negotiated, again, a peaceful resolution.
But at one point in there, he was abducted again by law enforcement.
That's right. That's right.
How did that happen?
You know, I can't remember the details of that particular moment, but he was constantly harassed, even though people on both sides knew that he was the principal figure who could help resolve these matters.
And what was it about this man, Hank Adams, that made him so gifted in this ability to negotiate with both sides?
This is one of the things that when I first met him in about 6-7 years ago at a treaty meeting in Washington, D.C., Vine had always described him as just a very humble individual. And when Hank walked into the room, he stood off in the corner, very quiet, very low-key. When we finally sat around the table to begin discussing treaties, he spoke very humbly, very mildly, no grandstanding, no bragging. He and Vine were part of that generation of leaders, along with Billy Frank, another leading activist from the Pacific Northwest. And Vine put it best when he received an award in 1985, just before he passed, where he said, "Our generation took issues seriously. We never took ourselves seriously." Mm-hmm. And I think Hank epitomized that as well as Vine and Billy Frank.
Interesting. I'm speaking with David Wilkins. He's the author of The Hank Adams Reader. He teaches American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota. The first issue that Hank Adams cut his teeth on was this issue of Native fishing rights in the Northwest. Talk a little bit about that, because that was a raging issue here in Wisconsin in the late 80s.
Right. In 1961, Hank was hired by the National Indian Youth Council, a leading, in fact, it was the first of its kind, a young, radical Native organization peopled by college graduates and college-age Native students who were frustrated by the leadership or the lack of leadership of the National Congress of American Indians, which was a leading intertribal organization. And Hank, while he had been born in Montana, he had moved to Washington State as a young man when he was 14 and had began to learn about issues confronting Native peoples up there. But when he was hired by the National Youth Council, which was stationed in Albuquerque, his first assignment was to go up to Washington State to investigate what was happening on the ground with the fishing rights wars, because the tribes in that state had signed a number of treaties in 1854 and 1855 guaranteeing them the right to hunt and fish and gather both on their reservation lands and on ceded lands around the reservation. And yet they had been denied those rights by fish and wildlife officials for the better part of a century and a half. And Hank knew that that was wrong, that it was a violation of treaty law, a violation of constitutional law, and he began to spearhead the strategy that ultimately led to court decisions that restored to the Native peoples their rights.
You reminded me in this book of a huge fallacy that was mentioned very commonly here in Wisconsin during these fishing controversies in the North, and that is that the sports fishermen would say, "Oh, the Indians are taking all the fish." And he had done a study that showed that Native fishing in the Northwest, as in Wisconsin, was just a tiny, tiny fraction compared to the sports fishing that was
absolutely,
going on.
Absolutely. The numbers are just staggeringly uneven. I mean, there are literally thousands of sports fishers in Washington State, several thousand commercial sports fishers, and literally just a few hundred Native fishers. And yet, you're right, the empirical evidence, even though it was all in favor of the non-Indians, all that was turned upside down and used against the Native fishers.
Now, I read that he was shot in the stomach at one point while he was defending Indian fishing rights. What happened?
Precisely. He was out there, again, trying to support the right of fishers to go out there and exercise their treaty rights guaranteed by the Constitution and the treaties that were ratified by the Senate. But while he was standing by his truck, two vigilantes came up and plugged him right in the gut. And fortunately, they rushed him to the hospital, and he was saved. He then filed charges. The police apparently never investigated those charges, and so those shooters were never apprehended.
Oh, that's outrageous. I'm speaking with David Wilkins. He's the author of The Hank Adams Reader. We're talking about Hank Adams, someone I'd actually never even heard of, I'm embarrassed to say. The subtitle of this interesting book is called An Exemplary Native Activist and the Unleashing the Unleashing of Indigenous Sovereignty. You know, he had a fascinating life. He's still alive, right?
Yes, he is.
He met a lot of interesting people. He worked with Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. How did he get to know them so prominently?
In the early 1960s, he was hired as a research assistant for Vine Deloria when Vine became the executive director of the National Congress of American Indians. And while Hank was in D.C., he had already cut his teeth on the fishing rights struggle, and he began to make connections with people in the know, like Ralph Nader and like Ralph Abernathy and like Robert Kennedy and others, because he knew that he was going, in order to create the kind of strategy that was required to get the laws changed and get public perception changed, he needed to have as many allies as possible. Mm-hmm. And so he did that both in the D.C., and he also did it, and he was able to manipulate the media in a way that most activists, I find, are not quite able to do. Hank enlisted the aid of Marlon Brando, of Jane Fonda, of Dick Gregory, and he did it in a way that was never trivializing of Native peoples or stereotyping them. He was able to exploit the resources and the knowledge and the contacts of these individuals to create documentaries and to create articles and books and news releases that really helped to spread the word about the rights of Native people.
I imagine that's why Nader admired him. I worked for Ralph Nader a couple years, and he always liked people, first of all, who weren't, you know, huge egos, and secondly, who really could make things happen.
Right.
And also were good with the media and got the word out. So
absolutely.
They seem like on the surface, you might not have put the two together, but once you see the two together, it makes a lot of sense.
Right.
He had, in the 60s, he had to serve in Vietnam. What experiences did he have there? How did that affect him?
He was drafted to serve in Vietnam, and he initially was going to initially refused the draft because he saw it as a violation of his own sovereignty as an Assiniboine Sioux. But then he ultimately relented and did agree to join. He wound up spending most of his time on a military base in Virginia, in which he was a writer and an editor for a newspaper. And that's where I think he developed a lot of his writing skills that he then parlayed into many of the documents that are included in his book here.
But he never served time over in Vietnam?
He never served time in Vietnam.
He was lucky then.
No. Right, very lucky.
You know, I was shocked to see that he ran for office a couple times. Not about that, but that he ran as a Republican.
Precisely.
And why that choice?
Yeah, he, along with Vine Deloria, was also a card-carrying Republican. But I think they were the kind of Republican that we don't see much of in evidence today. They believed in small government. They believed in less taxes and so on. And they believed in the government staying out of the personal affairs of individuals. But I wasn't able to really get him to open up about that so much, because I was anxious to learn more about that and to know whether he or not he still is a Republican.
You know, I was curious about that too. And a Native activist friend of mine was actually a fan of Richard Nixon. When he said that, I was shocked. Is Nixon known as someone who was very sympathetic to Native rights?
As a matter of fact, prior to Obama's presidency, Richard Nixon has been touted by most Native people in the know with having the best track record of any president of the 20th century. Hmm. He did a lot of positive things. He was the one that really spearheaded indigenous self-determination. He was one of the few presidents who actually returned land to a tribe. He did a number of things that were very supportive of tribal rights.
Do you have any idea why he was sympathetic?
You know, there have been a couple of books written about that, and author speculated that when Richard Nixon was a kid, he was befriended by an older Indian gentleman who really took him under his wing and apparently taught him a lot of stuff.
Isn't that interesting?
And that carried over, apparently.
I wish the same thing were true, that he had met a Jewish person when he was younger, because he was so anti-Semitic. What is Hank Adams doing today?
He continues to head up the Society of American Survival of American Indians Association, SAIA. And he continues to write. He continues to speak both locally and throughout the state. And occasionally he gets involved in certain national affairs, like the Little Bighorn Monument in the late 1990s. But Hank's had some health issues that sort of keep him close to home. So he hasn't been as active at the national level as he had been in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and early 90s. And yet he's still prolific, and he still writes a lot. I understand he has a very active Facebook account now.
Really?
And even though he's not very good about returning emails or phone calls, he's very active on Facebook.
How old a man is he?
He is now, I think, 64, I believe.
I'm speaking with David Wilkins. He's the author of this book, The Hank Adams Reader, an exemplary Native activist and the unleashing of indigenous sovereignty. You also have another book that was just handed to me before I came into the studio here with you, so I can't speak very intelligently about it, I have to say. But it's called The Legal Universe, Observations on the Foundations of American Law, which you co-wrote with Vine Deloria. Co-wrote would probably be the wrong word because he's been gone for several years. Mm-hmm. Tell me about this book.
This was a book I did a postdoc with Vine Deloria in the early 1990s, and when I arrived, he was teaching a course titled The Legal Universe for the law school. Vine had both a theological background as well as a legal background. And it was an important course because he took social contract theory, and we read a lot of John Locke and Rousseau and Thomas Hobbes. And trying to understand the foundations of America, the American legal system, and how that legal system has both sometimes, you know, enhanced the rights of disempowered minority groups, but has more often, you know, oppressed and abused the rights of those groups. And so I found it to be a stunning course. And then years later, after Vine and I wrote our first book together, he then approached me about teaming up with him on this book. He had already written several chapters. Vine was so prolific that he would literally write books or substantial chunks of books and would put them on a shelf until he felt that the time was right for them to be released. And he felt in the early 2000s that this book should be ready to go.
So he was like a musician that way.
Yeah, very much so. And so he handed me the partial manuscript and said, "Here, Wilkins, I want you to write the chapters on women and children and the natural world, and let's have us a good book." And so I began to do that, and we had really turned our attention to the book when his health turned in 2005, and then he passed away. And so it fell to me to try and finish it off, which was very difficult because Vine, being the brilliant person he was and having the depth of knowledge that he had about so many subjects, it was really hard to try and forge this course alone. But I had good support from Sam Shinta, our publisher, who was a good friend of Vine as well, and Vine's wife, who was actively in support of the project. And lots of good friends who read drafts of things, and I was able to finally get it finished off.
The one thing that struck me just as I glanced at that caught my interest was this comparison in the way that the United States government treated African Americans, Native peoples, and women. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about similarities and differences there?
It's interesting. One of the key concepts that we really talk about a lot in the book is how the term property has been articulated both by John Locke and how it plays out in social contract theory and how it plays out in how the Constitution is understood and how it's defined. And as we know, and as your educated audience would know, African Americans were considered the property of their owners, women the property of their husbands. And Native peoples, we had no property rights whatsoever because our lands had been discovered by non-Indians. And so that's a concept that sort of ties all these groups together. And it's a fact that we lack property rights and that the legal system has been devised and set up in such a way that it prevents us from acquiring the same kind of property rights of white propertied males that makes it very difficult for minority groups to really begin to prosper.
And those property discriminations were just embedded in the Constitution.
Precisely.
Bringing things up to the present, what are some of the most important issues facing Native peoples here in the U.S. today?
President Obama just had his third meeting in which he invited leaders of virtually all the recognized tribes to meet with him, which was just held last week. He issued a 30-page report touting what his administration had did for Native peoples, and yet many of the leaders in the audience were feeling, well, yeah, you've done some, but you haven't done as much as you said you had planned
to do.
That's
what a lot of us think about a lot of.
Exactly. And so for any country, we continue to face issues in terms of having our treaty rights respected by both corporate America, by states, and by federal agencies. We continue to face serious educational problems with dropout rates higher than any other racial or ethnic group. We face crime rates that are higher than literally any other segment of society. We face our young people commit suicide at rates 6 to 7 times higher than so on most every social index you can come up with. Native America continues to struggle. The presumption out there now is that Indian gambling casinos have turned us all into bronze-skinned Donald Trumps, and that's simply not the case. About 35 or 40 tribes are doing remarkably well given their geographic proximity to big cities, but most tribes are struggling still on many levels.
You talked about corporate America infringing on Native rights. How is that? Is that in going after minerals and resources?
Exactly. There are a number of pipelines that have been proposed. You have continuing uranium interest is now being renewed because of issues. Coal, about a fourth of the recoverable coal is on Indian land. Many of the natural resources that corporate America depends upon is held on the lands or underneath the lands of Native peoples. But because our property rights are so ill-defined in the law, we really lack absolute control over our resources and must still rely on the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which continues to be one of the most underfunded and inept agencies of the federal government. And so it's a constant tug of war as we try to protect what's left of our resources.
Speaking with David Wilkins, who teaches American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota, you know, one of the first pieces of investigative reporting I ever did when I was a young journalist in Washington, D.C., was ripoffs on Native American land. I think it was the Arapaho. Mm-hmm. Companies would come in, and they would just lie about how much, and they turned the dials back on how much oil they were taking out of the ground so they wouldn't have to pay the Indian tribes so much royalties.
Right. That's exactly right. There have been numerous investigations. In fact, I'm working on a new book now on indigenous claims, and I just finished just a couple of days ago the chapter on the Cobell class action lawsuit dealing with how the federal government has completely mismanaged individual Indian money counts dating back to the 1820s. And even though that was presumably settled in 2010 when Obama signed the law and Congress passed it into law, in fact, things have just been sort of put on hold because there has now been a commission appointed, and now they're going to have to investigate and try to come up with a new accounting system that will finally do justice to Native rights.
But tell me if I'm wrong about this. I thought Judge Lambert or one federal judge kept issuing one strict ruling after another, telling that the government, that, you know, get your act together. You owe Native peoples billions of dollars and give them their money.
That's exactly what Lambert did, and he became a very strong advocate for Native peoples because he saw, as he began to gain access and see what the federal government, how badly things had been mismanaged, he was absolutely taken aback. That then led the Department of Interior and the Department of Treasury to convince a federal court of appeals to have Lambert removed from the case in 2006, appointed by a conservative who then tried to lower the amount of money that the Native peoples were entitled to. Ultimately, that judge's ruling was overturned, and Congress finally negotiated a settlement of $3.4 billion last year, which was about $50 billion less than the Native peoples believed they were legally entitled to, but substantially higher than what the federal judge had originally accorded them. So it's another one of those compromise rulings in which Native people still get a pittance of what they're entitled to.
Yeah, and isn't that just a scandal in and of itself? David Wilkins has been my guest today. He's the author of The Hank Adams Reader, among other titles, including The Legal Universe, which he wrote with Vine Deloria. David Wilkins, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you very much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.